Well, thanks for having me back. It's good to be with you. If I've not met you, my name's Tim. I come from just up the street, South Harbor. So South Harbor sends you their blessings, and it's great to be back. We're going to be in Mark chapter 4. I know we're all rested this morning. You had a power outage planned last night. That's a great time for that. But you're here, and so we're going to be in Mark chapter 4. My one chip on my shoulder, I got a name before we get going, is I found out this morning that I'm the long one. Yeah, that's multiple sources. Somebody said, without naming names, do you just go till 2 o'clock at South Harbor? Yeah. We break for lunch. I'll do my best. I'll do my best to not be too long-winded. But yes, I guess the long way. I'm shorter than Jeremy, so it's not a height thing. I get it. But Mark chapter 4, you all have been exploring, we've all been exploring the Gospel of Mark and really asking the question, who is Jesus? Like, who is he really? If you take him off the stained glass, read through the Gospels, what did he stand for? What couldn't he stand for? Like, what were the things that got him upset? What was he passionate about? Why was it that Jesus was so controversial, so provocative, that the Roman political establishment would tag team with the Jewish political establishment and the religious leaders, and they would all say, hey, we got to kill this guy. And not only do we have to kill him, we should do it in broad daylight in a public venue so everyone can see it. Why was Jesus so provocative? And that conversation has led us through a number of different places. You have talked about politics. We've covered everything from politics to parables. There's been a little bit all over the place. What I want to try to do in this story that we get to look at is incredible. So what I want to try to do in using this story this morning is try to pull some of those threads together and see how they connect with one another. We're going to be in Mark chapter 4. We'll begin at verse 35. That day, when evening came, he, that's Jesus, said to his disciples, let us go over to the other side. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. Then there were also other boats with him. Now let's pause here. We are told that Jesus is going over to the other side, raising the obvious question, the other side of what? I don't have my laser pointer, so I'll do my best to kind of what we're referring to there is the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also known as Lake Tiberias, up in the north. Jesus is going to cross this. It's a freshwater lake. It's about four times the size of Reed's Lake in East Grand Rapids, if that helps. About 8 miles by 13 miles by 8 miles. So it's not a giant lake, but he's going to cross over to the other side of this lake. That is our setting. Now, before we go to the other side of the lake where he's heading, let's just take a couple of minutes. Jesus is coming from a region known as the Galilee. You've heard of the Galilee. Anybody been to the Galilee? Who are my Israel people here? Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. So Jesus is coming from a Galilee. Now, when you think Galilee, what should you have in your head? Think this is an area that had a reputation for being religious, morally upright. If you wanted to raise a family, you wanted to find a house in the Galilee if you're in the first century. If you were somebody who really wanted to instill a certain set of morals and principles into your kids, you wanted neighbors that were safe. You wanted a community involved. You would try to raise your kids in the Galilee. The Galilee was the place of highly religious Jewish people at the time of Jesus. Let me show you a couple of pictures. The first is obviously an artist's rendition of a housing complex. This is known as an insula. Families would share life together. You would essentially have all these small rooms. This is a metaphor Jesus uses, by the way, when he talks about, I'm going to prepare a place for you. In my Father's house, there are many rooms. The King James translated it mansions, which misses the point. Jesus is describing an insula. We each have a room in the insula of his Father's house. And in the center is the courtyard. The word insula actually means island. So in the center is like an island, and that's where life happens. You would meal prep together. You would cook together. You would eat together. You would play together. Here's another picture of, this is now Capernaum archaeological ruins, and you kind of see along the sides, you see just the foundation stones of the insula. And then in the center, you notice that there is a synagogue. At the center of every community in the Galilee was a synagogue. It was a place of worship. You would also worship together as a community. Life in the Galilee was simple, life was faith-oriented, and life was communal. It was essentially Jamestown of the ancient world. You wanted to raise family here, right? So this is why people are heading in. Now, Jesus is going to the other side. Let me show you that map again. He's heading to the other side, to the region known as the Decapolis. Our story is going to take place in likely a city called Hippos, which is kind of toward the north of that purple there. We're not told specifics, but likely in that region because it's the only, the story's going to have a cliff in it. It's the only city in the Decapolis that has a cliff. But Jesus is heading over to the Decapolis. So if life in the Galilee is communal, it's simple, it's faith-based, life in the Decapolis is the exact opposite. The word Decapolis it comes from two words, deca, which is 10, and polis, which is cities. 10 cities of the Decapolis. These are the exact opposite of the Galilee. When you hear Decapolis, it is, think drunkenness, debauchery, sin, NASCAR, all the bad things. Okay, so that's that. No one wants to go there. So when Jesus is going over to the other side, okay, we have to understand how shocking this is to the first audience, especially if the first audience are disciples. If Jesus is taking a group of disciples who, if they're culturally, if this is culturally accurate, are likely middle school and high school aged boys. This would be like Missy saying, "Hey, we're going to do a student trip this year, and we're going to Las Vegas, but just the seediest parts, right?" Like you're like, okay, we're leaving Jamestown to go there. Why would we do that? Now, to understand the Decapolis, understand it's Roman cities. We are in Roman world. The Decapolis were 10 Roman cities, and these 10 Roman cities were placed here on purpose. Let me show you a map of the Roman world. This is the Roman world. It kind of translates, but you notice the Roman world really ruled most everything. It kind of controlled the world, largest empire the world had ever seen up until this point. And it stretched all the way, kind of Spain, Portugal, but all the way to, you see the boundary line where it says Parthian Empire? See that? I don't have my laser pointer, right? It's right there. That's the border of the Roman Empire. Now, the thing to know about the Parthians is they couldn't beat them. It's modern day Iraq, Iran. The Romans couldn't, this isn't relevant at all for us today, but the Romans, anytime they tried to fight a war with Iran, discovered that that war would just drag on and on and on, and they couldn't win the war. So instead of trying to like conquer the Parthians, they said, let's just secure the border, so that none of the Parthians come into our world. Now, on the border is Israel. And so why do we have so many Roman military people living or introduced into our biblical story? And specifically, why is the Decapolis where the Decapolis is? Is because we need a place to put Romans so that we can make sure the Parthians won't ever enter. They tried. At one point, the Parthians did enter. They overthrew, just for a blip in history, they overthrew the Romans, and they actually placed their own king in. It's the backstory behind why when the Magi from the east say, "We heard there's a new king," Herod freaks out. The Parthians had done that once. The thing to know, this is Roman cities. We've got a border town. And what we know about the Decapolis is there was a specific kind of person that was moved to the Decapolis who was Roman. And that was military men. Either ex-military or active military men were moved there. Now, in our military, we have different divisions of military, right? In the U.S., we have, you know, Army, Navy, Marine, Air Force, Coast Guard. Did I get them all? Space Force. We got different divisions. They also had different divisions. They referred to their divisions of their military as a legion. A legion was anywhere between 2,000. This will all be relevant later. Just mentally note it. 2,000 to 6,000 Roman soldiers made up what was known as a legion. Now, they didn't refer to their legions as army, navy, like we do. They referred to their legions as First Legion, Second Legion, Third Legion, Fourth Legion. And what we know about this region is there was a specific legion that was placed in power in this region. In the city of Bethshan, one of the Decapolis cities, we discovered a handful of symbols. Let me show you what we found. We are told that this is Legion 10. Notice the image. I'll show you another picture found in Beth Shan. Legion 10 was discovered here. Now, Legion 10's symbol was a wild boar. Who's Legion 10? Well, Legion 10 was the private security legion. It was the favorite legion of a guy by the name of Julius Caesar, like the George Washington of the Roman world. So not only do we have military men on the border, we have probably the strongest. This is like Navy SEALs, the Green Beret. Like we've got them sitting on the border, Legion 10, symbolized by the wild boar. Now, let me show you a picture, some pictures of, again, this is Beth Shan. It's in the Decapolis. It's just the most excavated of the cities. But just to get a feel of what a Decapolis city would look like, notice it's how different it looks from Capernaum, Jesus' hometown. Giant colonnaded streets, probably the picture Jesus is thinking of when he says, wide is the road that leads to death, but narrow the path that leads to life. The street to Jerusalem is narrow. The Romans, all roads lead to Rome, and they put these massive wide roads in. You see it in the image. On the background, you got a theater. That is about propaganda as much as it's media. Propaganda, media. I think Ben talked about that a few weeks ago. So you got this. Let me show you the next picture. This is a fun one. This, any guesses as to what this is? It's a great guess. Tomb is a great guess. It kind of looks like a tomb, right? But actually, now here's what you got to imagine. Imagine wood, because wood is now rotted, but wood would be over top of these grates, and under it would be hot water. They called it a caldarium. We call it sauna. They had these indoor saunas with moving water. Like they have active plumbing. Like this is life in the Decapolis. It was lush. It was lavish. The Decapolis had a certain worldview behind it. So just outside of this room, this is part of the gymnasium complex. The gymnasium complex was where you trained your body. It was where you also trained your mind. All this took place in the center of the city. Now, in that, I don't have another picture of it, but the earlier picture of the, like, zoomed out, you notice that the one thing you don't see in the Decapolis are houses. There were houses, but they were often spaced out in the distance. The center of the city was all about the group of people coming together. Now, that tells us something about the Romans and how they did life, what they valued. To the Roman, what mattered was individualism, space, autonomy and privacy, individual, beauty. Beauty is what matters. And what is the most, a strength is what matters. And the most beautiful thing they said is you. The most beautiful thing that has ever been created is the human body. And the way they would show off the human body, you see this in Roman sculptures, is they said that the naked human body is like the most beautiful thing. So you would go, the word gymnasium comes from the word gymnos, which means, anybody know? Nude. It was a place where you would train in the, I think it would be awkward. But you would train in the nude. No, compare the two lives. You got the galley, simplicity, faith-oriented, community. Then you've got Decapolis, and what matters to the Decapolis, what matters to the Romans, strength, beauty, the naked human body, individualism, and violence. They said the only way you get to peace is through violence. Pax Romana was all about, the peace of Rome was all about, the way we get to peace is by taking out anyone who's against us. It's peace through violence. And Jesus says to his disciples, who are likely middle school, high school age boys, we're going to leave Jamestown and we're going to go to Vegas. Now you got to imagine that, like what they're thinking. But maybe more terrifying than just that idea, like this is, we're going there. Like the prodigal son story, when he leaves for a distant world, that's the image in their head. It's not distant as in it's super far away, but in worldview, distant world. The more terrifying than going to the Decapolis is how they're going to get there. Jesus says we're going to get in a boat. Verse 36. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. So Jesus is going to get there via boat. And that is terrifying. Let me show you a picture of the Sea of Galilee again. It's, this picture is taken from, can you remember this? Mount Arbel. Did you hike Mount Arbel? So Mount Arbel is my favorite hike in all of Israel. It's kind of a hard hike, but there's this moment you're hiking up a mountain and then all of a sudden you turn a corner and you see this. Like just about every picture you see of Galilee from a distance is Mount Arbel. It overlooks everything. Jesus, when he goes to a quiet place on a mountain to pray, the story from last week, that's likely he's going to Mount Arbel. It's where you can see everything. It's an incredible hike. But Jesus is, this is the Sea of Galilee, 13 by 8, freshwater lake, 3 tributaries kind of flowing down to feed the lake. It's actually absolutely beautiful. And first time I was there was in 2009, and I got to this point, and I'm like taken in by like as the guide's pointing out Capernaum and Bethsaida and all the cities in our Bible, and Jesus did that miracle here and that miracle there and that there. 80% of the miracles happened there. There was a question I had. Hey, look at the picture. See if you can anticipate what my question was. At that time, I was living in Holland. I was living by Lake Mack, if that helps. Anybody guess what my question is? Where are the houses? Like Lake Mack, like it's they're multi-million-dollar homes on a lake not nearly as nice as this one. Freshwater lake. Where are the mansions? Where are the sea dews? Where's all the master crafts? Like where is it all? Like why does it look like this? Why are all the ruins that we have found? There's a handful of small communities on the sea. Capernaum's on the sea, but why are most of them off in the distance? Why are they not by the water? And my guide said to me something that I. Once I knew this, so many other Bible stories just made sense to me. He said, Tim, you got to understand, actually the way he said it was, if you know the name, it was Ray Vanderlaan, and he can sometimes just say things. And he said, Tim, the thing you got to know is, he goes, you clearly don't read your Bible. I said, that's mean, Mr. Vanderlaan. But he's like, because if you read your Bible, you would know water. And he goes, very first story in your Bible, what does it say? And I was like, okay, well, the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And water in the beginning of our Bible is chaos. And he said, so to the Jewish imagination, especially in the first century, and there's still some remnants of this even to the modern Israeli, but to the Jewish imagination in the first century, the water was the abyss. It was, have you ever noticed how many Psalms talk about the raging waters, how the book of Job talks about Leviathan and Beelzebub, the god of death and flies, lives inside of the water. When Jesus, Jesus is on the water and they say, oh, it's a ghost. Why do you think he's a ghost? Well, ghosts live. This is what they believe. They said this is like where death lives. This is demons live here. Ever been to a funeral and, you know, a pastor gets up and they're reading this beautiful passage in Revelation about how God's going to restore the world and there'll be no more weeping or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order has passed away. I saw a new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. And then John, the author, says, and there was no longer any sea. And all of us who live in Michigan who love water think, wait, what? Heaven has no water? I love water. That's not what John is saying. John is saying, there's no longer any abyss. There's no evil. God's going to deal with the evil in the end. The evil doesn't come. Like, God's going to deal with the chaos. God's going to deal with the abyss. So Jesus says to his disciples, we're going to go to the part of the world that is terrifying to you, and we're going to get there via boat, and we're going to do that by crossing the sea. They're fishermen. They've been on the water, but if you ever notice when you read the fishermen's stories, they're always just off the shore. Like, Peter can jump out of the boat and touch ground yet. They're not used to going deep into the Sea of Galilee. Jesus is the only one who keeps calling them out there. Then we read this. A furious squall came up. Is that weird language? Squalls usually come down, right? It's like, Mark wants you to know it's like the evil is reaching up. And the waves broke over the boat. It's like the evil's coming up out and trying to pull him down. And it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, Teacher, don't you care if we drown? So squall comes up over the boat. There's other boats with him, remember. But apparently Mark wants us to know, like, it's kind of just this boat. It's like it's being attacked. And to their mind, that makes sense. furious squall, waves broke over the boat, nearly swamped. And where's Jesus? Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. If that's not a thing we feel at times, right? Like you've been there, it's like, we're coming on the 1 year anniversary of friends of ours, really close friends who lost a child. And it's, you lose a loved one and it's like, God, where are you in this moment? And it's, you look around and it's like evil itself is trying to pull you down. And where's God? Well, it feels like he's sleeping on a cushion and don't wake him, please. That's what it feels like. Maybe it's something at school. Kids can be really cruel, right? Kids can be, Ben said, middle school can be hard. That's just true, right? Middle school is hard. High school is hard. College is hard. Adulting is hard. Like people can just sometimes be cruel. And maybe you're in school and somebody found that one thing that you're uncomfortable with or that one thing you're sensitive about, and they've now turned that into a joke and you got to go every day. Or maybe it's a marriage and you find yourself pulling in the garage and thinking, do I have the energy to go into this house because I know what I'm going to face? And it's like the evil's coming up and God, where are you? Jesus was in a stern, sleeping on a cushion. It's what it can feel like. Verse 39, he got up, rebuked the wind, and he said to the waves, quiet, be still. Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you have no faith still? They were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even demons, even the wind and the waves obey him. Yeah, it's not that Jesus doesn't care when we're in those moments. He's just not afraid, right? That's what he needs them to see. Like, do you understand who's in the boat with you? He's far greater than whatever is living in that sea. Our story doesn't end there. There's a reason Jesus is going to bring his disciples to this other side. Mark 5. They, that's Jesus and his disciples, went across the lake, that is the Sea of Galilee, freshwater lake, to the region of the Gerasenes, that is Decapolis. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. The man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart, and he broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice. The demon-possessed man, so you gotta like, what do you want with me, Jesus? Something like that. My precious son, like, son of the Most High God, in God's name, don't torture me. For Jesus had said to him, come out of this man, you impure spirit. Then Jesus asked him, what is your name? My name is Legion, he replied, for we are many. Legion. Imagine, remember, Mark's audience, living in Rome, under Nero's persecution. The Roman military is known as a legion. Mark's audience hears something in this story that we should not miss. This is somehow a confrontation with an impure spirit, yes. But this is somehow also a confrontation with the very powers behind the Roman military machine, period. He begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them. Jesus gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out, and they went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake, and they were drowned. How many pigs? Have we heard that number? How big is a legion? 2,000 to 6,000. Why pigs? Now, we don't know for certain. I can't say that it's Legion 10. Symbol was a wild boar, and this is directly... I can't prove that. The text doesn't say that. I can only tell you we have found emblems of Legion 10 in this area. We know the Legion was there. And where, by the way, where do... Here's a detail that's weird, right? You read your Bible. Every once in a while, it's like, what? Jesus, they beg Jesus, don't send us into nothing. That's what the demons say. Please send us into something. And then Jesus sends them into pigs. And what's the first thing they do? Drown themselves? Is that detail ever like, wait, what? Why would they? Is this suicidal bacon? Like, what is happening here? What is going on? Why would they drown themselves? They beg not to go into nothing. And now they're, again, What is the sea to the Jewish imagination? The abyss. They're just going home. That's how they would read this. They're just going home. Those tending the pigs, this is like their job, right? This is our income stream, just ran into the water, ran off and reported this to the town and the countryside. And the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus, leave our region, leave, please, Jesus, leave. Now, remember the values of Rome: beauty, strength, individualism, violence. That's how we get peace. Is this man strong? Yeah. Yeah, they can't even chain him. He breaks the chains. Is this man a beauty via the naked human body? Is he naked? Yeah. If he's dressing in his right mind, that leads us to believe he was naked before. Is he an individual? Yeah. Nobody wants to be around this guy. He's all by himself living in the tombs. Is he violent? Cutting himself with rocks. Like, what is Mark painting for us here? Who is this guy? Everything the Roman culture said, this is life. Jesus shows us in this one moment, you think that's life? That's insanity. Life is in the insula. Life, you would trade cooking a meal with grandma, eating a meal with your cousins, and you would trade all that for a bigger house in the middle of nowhere? That's crazy. You would trade a sense of security in your own flesh. This is the body God gave us. You would trade all of that for, oh, I got to look a certain way. I got to keep up. That's insanity. That's demonic. But it's everything Rome celebrated. Can you imagine that world where beauty is all people care about? Weird, right? Like, can you imagine that place? What would happen if we were to hear leaders talk, like the thing they would say, that all that matters is our strength, not humility, not strength. Wild. Or if all you saw was a culture that was hyper fixated on the individual. Sounds like our world, right? How about violence? Peace through violence. Can we just, are we at the spot culturally where we can at least acknowledge that as a culture, we love violence? We would never say that, but we truly don't think that there's other ways to get to peace other than violence. We just see that. It's like the way we solve problems culturally. And this is like not a political thing. This is an all of us thing culturally. We just got there. We all witnessed several months ago now somebody get assassinated, killed in broad daylight. And a whole group of people say, well, he deserved it. And then a few months later, somebody on the other side of the political aisle, a couple people, they get killed. And we heard the other side say, well, they deserved it. That's insanity. That's, dare I say, demonic. And yet as a culture, this is just the spot we're in. Story continues, verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him. He said, go home to your own people. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. Okay, Jesus does something powerful. And what do the people say? Leave, please leave. This guy goes and he tells his neighbors, and all the people are amazed. Just note that. Now, imagine you're a disciple. Jesus says, we're going to cross this lake. We're going through the chaos. You probably have no idea why Jesus would want you to go through that chaos. Maybe you're in a space in your life right now where it feels like chaos, and you have no idea why God would bring you into this place or allow you to go to this place. And where is God in this place? We read this story. Why does Jesus allow the disciples to go through the storms? Let me give you three quick observations. Observation number one, perhaps Jesus knows that what's on the other side or who's on the other side is worth it. Here's a detail in the story that I find heartbreakingly beautiful. Okay, so Jesus gets in a boat in the Galilee with his disciples, and they cross over to the Decapolis. He meets a demon-possessed man. There's the pig thing. They beg him to leave. Jesus then gets back in a boat, and he heads back home. I missed this for years, but this whole thing, the storm, the chaos, the demons, all of it existed for this one guy. Jesus did it all for one guy. If you were to pick Jesus, can I just pick your brain, Jesus, after this moment? Like, why did we do all that? All you did was help one person. That's all you did was help one person. It tells us something about our God. It tells us something about our God. He will meet us wherever we are. Maybe you feel like you're on the shore. It's like you can see Jesus, we're getting in a boat, and you see like the storm that's coming. And maybe for you, it's like you're in high school and you're about to go to college, and it's like, I'm terrified. Like, I finally found my people in high school, and now I'm going and I got to start over. Or you're about to have a child for the first time, and you're like, I don't know that I know how to do this. Like, I don't know that we're going to do, I don't know that we know how to do this. Or maybe you're in a spot where you have that baby, and you look at that little baby, and you're thinking, I really hope I don't mess this all up. Like, I just, you're on the shore. Or maybe you find yourself in the middle of the storm, and maybe you're in the storm right now. I got some friends in the storm right now. Maybe you're in the storm right now, and it feels like Jesus is sleeping. And we need to be reminded that Jesus does crawl in that boat. As we looked at last week, Jesus will eventually, no matter if it feels like he's watching from the mountain, and he will come down. He won't leave you forever in that. Or maybe you find yourself on the other side. You feel a bit like the demon-possessed man. You're a young church. You've got people here that this is probably, I won't call you out, but this is probably your first church experience. And my guess is you first stepped into the doors and you probably said to yourself, I think we could do it because it's school. It's not a church building, but I will leave and I'll just pretend like, oh, we didn't know we were here for something else. If these people are weird, if they judge me for my tattoos, if they judge me for like they know something about my background. There's a number of people in our world that are wondering, is my life too broken that Jesus would never come to me? And what we see in the story is Jesus will leave everything and risk everything for one person. That's the first observation. Second observation. Let's play a game. Pay attention to the pronouns. Let's go back through the story, but just highlight a couple lines. Pay attention to the pronouns. Story begins with Jesus saying, let us go over to the other side. They took him, Jesus, along. They were terrified. They went across the lake. When Jesus got out of the boat, when he saw Jesus from a distance, as Jesus was getting back into the boat, and then if you keep reading, it's they head back home. Catch it? Where are the disciples? They're still in the boat. They never get out of the boat. They cross. They see this crazy guy on a beach, and Jesus gets out of the boat. Jesus has this interaction. They beg Jesus to leave, and they go back home, but the disciples never get out of the boat. If you see the same world I'm seeing right now, and you're paying attention to the same stories I'm seeing, our world right now is begging for a group of Christians who are willing to get our hands dirty and actually get out of the boat. Not just talk about a Jesus who loves people who are hurting, but actually be the people who say, we so follow Jesus, we're willing to follow. We're going to do the same. If you want to be a disciple, we have to be willing to at least trust him enough to follow him out of the boat. A couple years ago, this is in a former life now, I was at Vriesland Church, and I was in a meeting, a consistory meeting. And I get a phone call, but because I'm in a meeting, I put it on silent, and I finish my meeting, and then I get a voicemail on the other end after the meeting, and I listen to it, and it's a young guy, 18 or 19 maybe, and he, on the other end of the phone, said, Tim, I'll just tell you what he said. He said, Tim, I can't do it anymore, and I am going to kill myself. I can't keep going on. Life is too hard. He had gone through a handful of really hard things, and that was his message. Thankfully, that didn't happen. He's doing great right now, but I get this message. A couple days later, on Facebook, somebody who has no idea who this guy even is, I get a message from a female. She's a middle-aged female, and she writes me this. I had been walking beside her for a couple of months, and she said, "I believe my purpose in life is to live." I had asked this question in a sermon, and she responded. She said, "I believe my purpose in life is to live. I know that that is what everyone thinks and feels, and that should be a given, not a purpose. But to me, life is a challenge. For years, all I have wanted to do is die. I feel like my life was a mistake, a huge mistake that everyone that came in contact with me would soon regret ever meeting me. I've come to realize that I was very wrong, and my purpose is to live. Live my life the way God wants me to live a life for Jesus who gave his life for me. My purpose is to live my life. Speaking of my life to those that are living, feeling, dealing with what I've already lived, felt, and dealt with, to comfort and help them through it. I've come to realize that living through my past helps me live into my purpose to live a life for others and not just for myself." And I received this, and I'm just becoming less and less convinced of coincidences. A couple days after this guy says, I'm going to take my life. And I just had this moment where I realized, they sit in the same building every single Sunday. They have no idea who each other are. I am not much help to this young man. I want to be, but I don't know how to even empathize. I've not been there. But what would happen if she were to meet him? That could be powerful. Jesus is, we know from our Bible, Matthew 25, Jesus says, "I'm going to be with the people who are hurting, who have no clothes, who are sick. I'm going to be with them. If you want to follow me, then you got to come with me, but I'm going to be out there." So if that's where Jesus is, as disciples of Jesus, we have to be willing to follow him, which means we have to be willing to get out of the boat. One of my favorite quotes from one of my favorite theologians, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Rogers, said it this way. You guys know this quote. He says, "When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping.' To this day, especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I'm always comforted by realizing that there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world. Where are the helpers?" Third observation, last observation. How do we do this? I didn't go to seminary, Tim. I don't know the answers. What if they ask me a question? Explain the Trinity. I don't know how to do that. Notice this detail in the story. Okay, so Jesus heals this demon-possessed man. He's now dressed in his right mind. And what was his question to Jesus? Do you remember? "Can I come with you?" And Jesus' response was, "No." What? Like, can you imagine somebody saying, "I would like to follow Jesus. Could I follow Jesus?" Well, Jesus said no. Jesus says no. But why does Jesus say no? Notice what he says. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you." So the man went away and he began to tell the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. So the guy runs home. Remember, they beg Jesus to leave. They want nothing to do with Jesus. They're scared of him. They saw his power. They're terrified. This guy, they're his neighbors. So he goes back and he begins to tell, and people are amazed. "We knew what your life was." Now, how much theology does this guy have? How many seminary degrees? How much Bible does this man have memorized? If he's living in, he's a demon-possessed man living in the Decapolis, I think it's safe to say he has no clue who this guy even is. All he knows is a dude got on a boat, came out, spoke to the demons in me, and now I'm healed. It's all he's got. All he's got is his own story. That's it. He probably can't explain Torah. He probably can't explain even, he probably doesn't even know the name Yahweh. Probably doesn't have any of that. He's living in the Decapolis. All the man has at this point in the story is his own personal story. That's seems to be for Jesus, that's enough. What's your story? I've learned that when somebody is an addict, I'm not very helpful. But there is a gentleman in our church who is a recovering addict that I have learned to immediately call because he can speak to the addict in a way I can't. We have a handful of people in our church who have lost children. I can't imagine that pain. And I have learned, walking through this with a group of friends, to call them and say, what's helpful, what's not helpful? Because they are experts in that unique form of tragedy. I have friends who have gone through divorces, and they've been hard, and they gutted them, and they're trying to still find ways to love each other enough for their kids and all of that. And I have learned to call upon them when it's someone in our community who's in the midst of that. What is your story? How might God use it? What is your, like, I was this, and then a dude got off a boat, and now I'm this. I was this, and then I met Jesus, and he healed me, and now I'm less that. Now I'm this. What is your story? For two chapters, Jesus goes back home. For two chapters, he's in the Galilee. Then we get to chapter 7, and Jesus, notice this, he's going to come back to the Decapolis for the first time. So he's, last time he was in the Decapolis, they begged him to leave. Next time he comes back to the Decapolis, we read chapter 7, verse 31. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee, into the region of the Decapolis. There, some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and when they begged Jesus to place his hands on them. First time Jesus does it for just one guy, they beg him to leave. Now we have people coming to him, and what are they bringing? Sick people. Why? Because that's probably all they know he can do. He's a guy who can heal. He healed me, he can heal you. Then a chapter goes by, chapter 8. During those days, another large crowd gathered in the Decapolis. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus will feed them. And that's where Jesus will say, oh, do you know who I really am? Jesus seems to say, it's enough. Know your story. I will meet them with the answers behind it. Your theology is not you get out of the boat. You be my hands and feet in a hurting world. You tell your story. How was your life changed? The questions you don't have answers to, I'll come along. It'll be okay. What starts out as one guy becomes some people, which will later become a large crowd. All because this guy dared tell his story. What is our story? Will we follow Jesus to get out of the boat? When we do that, well, that's really dangerous. Jesus will get killed for doing that. Empire loses its power. That kind of life is dangerous. And I think it's the kind of life Jesus called us to live. We're going to take communion this morning. And I am the long one. We're going to take communion this morning. And Jesus, when he did this on the night he was betrayed, talks about breaking himself open and pouring himself out for the needs of the world. And then he invited his disciples to do the same. And so we take communion to be reminded that when we are broken, Jesus meets us in that brokenness. But we also take it as a commissioning into a world that needs the church to break ourselves open and to pour ourselves out in his name again. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Father, we pray that you would make this space holy and sacred. God, we love you. We ask that you step into whatever suffering and pain we're feeling right now and bring healing. But Lord, help us to realize that you've healed us so that we might be good news to a world that desperately needs good news. Jesus, we love you, and we pray this in your name. Amen.